You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. I like the description of Justice Antonin Scalia as both a, quote, conservative legal thinker and disruptive public intellectual, unquote. Was he unscrupulous or principled? Was he both? Legal scholar Richard Hassan offers a nuanced perspective on the influential justice and the contradictions of his legacy that may have helped delegitimize the very institution he was trying to save. According to Hassan, Justice Scalia's legacy is not fading. It is, in fact, only growing stronger. In a recent piece for Slate, he notes, quote, over the next decades, Justice Scalia is likely to have greater influence in death than life. Antonin Scalia was nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States in 1986 by President Ronald Reagan and served for nearly 30 years. He believed that the Constitution and the law should be interpreted based on their actual text and original public meaning. And today we'll take a look at what that legacy means as we welcome legal scholar Richard L. Hassan, whose new book, The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption, has just been published by Yale University Press. Rick Hassan is Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at UC Irvine and a recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. He was named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal, and he's also the author of Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections. Erwin Chemerinsky is the founding dean of UC Irvine School of Law, and he's now decamped to Oakland, we miss him, where he's the dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law. He's the author of 8 books, it could be 9 by now since I last spoke to Erwin. Most recently, The Case Against the Supreme Court. He has argued several cases before the Supreme Court and various circuits of the United States Courts of Appeal, and we're delighted to welcome him back to Aloud today for his conversation with Rick Hassan. Please welcome our 2 distinguished guests. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be here again. It's wonderful meeting back home in Southern California. It's great to be here to discuss my dear friend and former colleague Rick Hassan's book, The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption. I think I want to start with a provocative question, and that is Antonin Scalia to be regarded as a hero or as a villain?
It's a great question, but before I answer it, let me just thank you for coming down from Berkeley and having a little UC Irvine reunion here. And also thank the Library Foundation for this opportunity and this beautiful space. It's really one of my favorite places to speak and have a conversation. So I'm looking forward to it. So was Justice Scalia a hero or a villain? I think it depends on who you ask. I start the book, the opening line of the preface is, Justice Scalia was a polarizing figure in polarized times. And he was seen as a hero by some, and is, I think, has become deified by many in his death, and seen as a villain by others. He was an unprincipled justice. And I think he helped make the court a more politicized institution, and he made the justices be seen, and we'll probably talk about this in his role as a public intellectual, be seen as celebrities and be seen as people to be emulated or people to be vilified. A few weeks ago, I was speaking at an event at the Brennan Center, and the Brennan Center put out a tweet that said, come here, Rick Hassan and Joan Biskupic talk about Justice Scalia's complexities. And somebody responded to that tweet by saying, Scalia was a partisan hack. And someone responded to that by saying, Scalia was the only principal justice, and what he did was applied the law as written. And I took a screenshot of that. I said, you know, this is the problem. If you don't talk about him as a hero or a villain, if you want to talk about the complexity of the person, it's hard to have that conversation. And I hope this book lets us see some of the nuance in who he was and what he did.
Why did you write a book about Antonin Scalia? There are other biographies on Scalia. Why another one?
So I know you ask this question knowing the answer, since you were a big part of it, but it is worth sharing.
Though I have to tell you, when you first told me you were thinking of writing a book about Justice Scalia, I asked exactly the same question that I pose now.
This is true. So about 6 years ago, I wrote a book proposal called The Scalia Court, and my argument was Justice Scalia was the most influential justice on the court. And I sent it to a few people and got some feedback, and it wasn't quite right. And I put the project aside, worked on other projects. And then about a little over 2 years ago, one Saturday morning, I woke up and I sent an email to my dean, Erwin Chemerinsky, and I said, I think I'm going to pick up the Scalia project again. Do you have some time that we can meet and talk? Erwin wrote back a few hours later and said the justice just passed away. It was February 13th, 2016, the very day that Scalia... So I knew that I had to write this book. And what I wanted to do was to present the complexity of the person. I was always fascinated by Justice Scalia. His opinions were always the most interesting to read, even when they were infuriating. He was a beautiful writer. He was a provocative person. And I thought he was much more interesting. But yet, he was what David Cole of Georgetown called in a piece right after Scalia died, the most influential justice on the Supreme Court without influence in Supreme Court history. Because if you think about what makes a Supreme Court justice influential, well, there are two ways we might measure this. One is we might say, did they write the most important majority opinions in the toughest cases? And aside from criminal procedure cases and a case involving gun rights called Heller that we might talk about, he rarely wrote those opinions. Another way of thinking about who's the most influential justice is who's the swing justice? Who's the one who wakes up in the morning and decides whether partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution or doesn't? That would be Anthony Kennedy. That's not Scalia. But Scalia is cited more than any of the other Supreme Court justices. His opinions are discussed more. And it was through the sheer force of his writing and his personality that he was able to gain such influence and get a collection of acolytes, people who are now coming onto the courts from the Supreme Court down to the lower courts, who are trying to emulate his views, and in some cases, as with Justice Gorsuch, as we might talk about, emulate his snarkiness. And I think he changed the nature of what it means to be a lawyer and a judge and a public legal intellectual. And so I was just fascinated by him. This was very much outside my comfort zone, which is why I had to rely on you to figure out the religion cases, the criminal procedure cases, all the areas of law that I don't usually study, and figure out where Scalia fit in those cases.
And you do a masterful job in all areas. And one of the great things about this book is its clarity and its accessibility. But I want to talk about a contradiction that came to my mind as I was just listening to you. You said he was a beautiful writer, but you also said he's known for, and I'm going to use your word, his snarkiness.
Yes.
I find a contradiction there. I don't find his writing beautiful and the sarcasm that he brought to the court in the decision with regard to marriage equality in 2015. In a footnote, and he was dissenting, he said, if he ever joined an opinion like Justice Kennedy's majority opinion, even to get 5 votes, he wouldn't leave his house without a bag over his head. Right. I don't think that belongs in Supreme Court opinions. I don't think that's beautiful writing.
Right. So yes. So it is a contradiction. But I'll tell another story that that's about Scalia, but not Scalia himself. That kind of illustrates the dual nature of how people thought about him. Years ago, Justice Scalia was down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Doing some hunting, and he gave a talk at Louisiana State University. And he gave the talk afterwards, and this is reported by who was then a professor, now a Ninth Circuit judge, Bybee, who was a professor there who was hosting Scalia. And Scalia has this reception line, and a law student walks up and says, you know, Justice, I really admire you, and, you know, thank you very much. And the student said, no, I really admire you. I admire you so much, I even name my pet fish after you. And Justice Scalia said, oh, you called it Nino? Well, Nino was what Scalia went by. He said, oh, no, I would never be that familiar. I called it Mr. Justice Scalia. And so then the student moved on, and Judge Bybee went up to the student and said, this is interesting. So do you have a whole Supreme Court of fish in your... And the student said, no, I would only name fish after justices that I like Justice Scalia. And so now Judge Bybee was really curious which justices deserved a fish and which didn't. So he said, so which justices do you have in your fishbowl? And he said, I only have Justice Scalia. He killed all the other justices. And so this story was told by Paul Clement at an event soon after. This story has been told a lot, but it was told by Paul Clement soon after Justice Scalia's death to illustrate that, you know, he wasn't really a killer. You know, he had this killer instinct, but in the end, he was charming. So Justice Ginsburg, who was very liberal but was a lifelong friend of Justice Scalia's, said, you know, I love him, but sometimes I like to strangle him. Justice Sotomayor, another court liberal, said, he was like family, but sometimes if I had a baseball bat, I don't know what I would do. But the thing about Scalia is that he was a personal charmer. He was the class clown. He would ask the funny questions. He could turn a phrase like no one else. He said he wrote his dissents for law students, make them pizzazzy. That was his word. So people would put law professors would put the opinions in their casebooks, so law students would read them, and people would learn his ideas. So he had this charming, funny side, and he wrote very directly and nimbly, but yet he had this snarkiness to him. So I did a study of how sarcastic justices' opinions are described as by law professors in law review articles, and Scalia is, in Supreme Court history, the most sarcastic justice. And his attacks were by far. So, you know, you look at how many times his opinions would be described that way. It was often. He would call other justices' opinions irrational, absurd, cannot be taken seriously. And his attacks, the worst part about his attacks is that they were not just ad hominem, like the I'd hide my head in a bag. They were meant to delegitimize his opponents. They were meant to suggest that he was doing judging, but the other justices were super legislators who were doing politics. He was the one that was above politics. And so he used his great gift of language to attack. And he would sometimes punch down at lawyers. There was a beauty to how he could write. I wish I could turn a phrase like him. And yet there was this sharp edge to him that I think not only didn't serve him well in terms of making friends on the Supreme Court, it didn't serve him well in terms of promoting the civility of the court. And I remember a few times I would describe writing as beautiful in my drafts, and you would say, this doesn't look beautiful at all to me. So we do disagree, but I think you can kind of admire the craft. He had a great craft of writing. He could do an insult like no one else, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily all to be emulated.
And my concern about it is I think it's a terrible example for law students and lawyers about how to write. And I think it has had an effect in that way. I want to talk about your title, titled Justice of Contradictions. And yet, as I think of Antonin Scalia, I think he was one of the most ideologically consistent justices on the court. I could count on less than the fingers of one hand the instances where he didn't come to conservative results, that his results seem more to mirror the 2016 or 2012 Republican platforms than anything else. So why do you call him a justice of contradictions?
Well, I do think that he was quite conservative, and that usually he decided cases the way the conservative majority on the court would. He would point to, for example, his flag-burning decision, where he says that a law that says burning the American flag is illegal would violate the First Amendment. He would point to his criminal procedure cases, where in some but not all cases, he would side with criminal defendants, for example, on the right to confront one's witnesses or his views about search and seizure. But for the most part, he was conservative. There are a number of contradictions. We talked about the contradiction involving his use of language. But the greatest contradiction, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, is this idea that he was someone who said, I have found the Holy Grail for how to read the Constitution and how to read a federal statute. It is to apply in the constitutional area original public meaning, which means what did the people at the time the Constitution was written think it would have meant at the time? And for texts, what a plain English language reading of the text would have meant. And he presented this is the way that's going to make the courts legitimate, because it's going to put the courts in their role. But yet, the way he approached this, not only in being inconsistent in his application of principles of originalism and textualism, which we can talk about. But in denigrating anyone who would not follow his views, he ended up delegitimating the very institution he said he was aimed at trying to legitimate. And so the largest contradiction is, I think he's left us with a much more political court, even though he said he was doing law and not politics. In fact, the justices, when they have to decide what the words equal protection or due process mean, there's not enough guidance from the text of the statute. And so ultimately, it comes down to a question of the justices' values. This is true of all of the justices, but Scalia was the one who denied it and said what he was doing was something else, was some kind of formalistic, neutral lawmaking that, you know, you just follow A, B, and C and you're going to get the right results. And yet, it was so obvious, if you look at his results, that he was not that way. And just a good numerical example of this, one of the last terms of the Supreme Court, when Justice Scalia sat on the court, there were 16 cases decided on a 5-4 vote. In 15 of the 16 cases, Justice Alito, who was neither an originalist nor a textualist, but who was very conservative, voted with Justice Scalia. And in those 16 cases, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia agreed only once. And so the lesson I learned from this is that if you want to know how the court's going to vote, you don't ask, is the justice applying originalism, as Justice Stevens did in the Heller case, to say there is no individual right to guns. You don't ask, is it originalism or is it textualism? You ask, was this justice appointed by a Democratic president? Was this justice appointed by a Republican president? And increasingly, that tells us much of the time, in the most important cases, how these things are going to go.
I think one of the profound insights of the book that you just mentioned is that Justice Scalia was trying to act to legitimize the court, but actually had the effect of delegitimizing the court. Is it Justice Scalia that's delegitimized the court, or is it just the times that we live in? In a very polarized time, is there any way for the Supreme Court to be other than a polarized institution?
Well, at the very least, I can say that Justice Scalia did not make things better, but he may have made them worse. So one of the things I look at are the justices as celebrities. In the 1960s, there were some justices who would make public appearances. They wouldn't really talk about very much about the court. So Justice William Douglas was a big environmentalist. He would give speeches, actually go hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail, and he'd invite regular people to come with him. I can imagine that today, if you could go hiking with a Supreme Court justice, what that would be like with our social media, you know, sightings of Justice Breyer on the Appalachian Trail. So they didn't really talk very much about the court. Then the court's very quiet, and oral arguments is very quiet. You could have someone come, you have 30 minutes for argument in many cases, you have to come up for 20 minutes and not get interrupted with a question. Scalia comes on the court, shakes things up. Not only does he start doing public appearances, he starts doing public appearances where he makes really provocative statements like, living constitution, I like my constitution dead, dead, dead. And, you know, criticizing the justices who do anything else. Foreign law, what's that got to do with us? Bush versus Gore, get over it. That was one of his favorite lines. And he was one of the founders of the Federalist Society, which is a group of law students, lawyers, and judges who believe in conservative and libertarian values. And it created a network of judges where justices like Scalia would come speak at the National Convention. They'd forward out these ideas of originalism and textualism. I talk about the rise of the originalism industry. It took a kind of off-the-wall idea and made it acceptable and even orthodoxy within conservative legal circles. So he helped to politicize and polarize the court. There he is on 60 Minutes. He's now written a book. And so then in response, you start getting the liberal justices doing the same thing. In fact, I blame Justice Scalia in part for Justice Ginsburg's very intemperate decision to criticize Donald Trump during the summer of 2016. She may have opinions about Donald Trump that she can share with her friends, but if you're a Supreme Court justice who might get Clinton versus Trump as a case before you while the election is pending, you really shouldn't be making public comments. But yet she feels, I think, or felt the need to respond to Scalia. So I think his whole role as a public intellectual and persona, turning oral arguments into these boxing matches, really helped polarize the court. So I can't prove it because it happens at the same time, and he was a creature of the polarization, but I at least we can say he didn't make it better.
And is that what you mean by the subtitle of the book, where you say Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption?
So the politics part I've explained, that Justice Scalia, just like every other justice, is making political decisions. I don't mean partisan decisions. I don't mean what's going to help the Democratic or Republican Party. But I mean making a value judgment. It's not just neutrally applying law. But the disruption part, I analogize Scalia to what Scalia did to the Supreme Court, to what Newt Gingrich did to the House of Representatives in 1994, and what Donald Trump has done to the presidency in 2016. That is, came in, the institution had a certain way of doing things, and let's blow this up. Let's try to change this in a way that is anti-elitist, populist, nationalist, anti-immigrant, like all of the things that you might say about Trump, a lot of those things you could say about Scalia or about Gingrich. And so there is a political strain to Scalia that he often said, I have my political opinions and my legal opinions that are not the same. But in lots of ways, it bled in the most important cases.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Assumed in what you're saying is that all of this is undesirable. Why not say that it's a really good thing to recognize that this is an emperor that has no clothes? If it is all about the value judgments of the justices, why shouldn't we recognize that? And why not have justices out there, not talking, let's put aside Justice Ginsburg and her comments about the election, but beyond that, isn't it better to allow people to see the justice at events like this when they do books or on TV? They're human beings. Shouldn't we regard them as such?
Well, I think there are questions about what the justices should do. So taking the last part of your question first, I think Justice Sotomayor, Justice Thomas, have both been known to go into high schools, especially in poor areas, and talk about how you can work your way up from nothing as they did. They came from very poor, disadvantaged backgrounds, and they've made it to the pinnacle of the legal profession. I think that's great. I think Chief Justice Roberts, speaking in his annual report or speaking to Congress about the needs of the courts and protecting the rule of law, I think that's great. What I don't like is when the justices are gladiators. And so there's a group, we talked about the Federalist Society, there's a group called the American Constitution Society, which is the much smaller liberal analog to the Federalist Society. There hasn't been a sitting liberal Supreme Court justice that has spoken at the Federalist Society. There hasn't been a sitting conservative justice that has spoken at ACS. I think they need to do more things to try to lower the temperature. And I think there are justices who are in the center of the court who I think could play that role. And have it. Now, in terms of recognizing that in the end the justices are making value judgments, I think it depends on the question of what you think about where the Supreme Court derives its legitimacy. I agree with you that we shouldn't pretend that the justices are not making value judgments, but that doesn't mean it's all politics. So I just recently completed a study looking at how the Supreme Court divides in its cases. And it turns out that not only are we at a high point in terms of the number of 5-4 or one justice opinions, we're also at the high point in the number of unanimous opinions at the same time. That sounds a little bit like a contradiction. But it turns out that Supreme Court's doing two things. One thing it's doing is deciding these high-profile political cases, the ones that make it to the front page of the New York Times that we all hear about. But it's doing another function too, which is it's helping to resolve disputes in areas where politics do not play a role. I do think that there is a difference between law and politics. There is a space. And if we completely politicize the court, then even those questions where you could get a liberal and conservative judge to otherwise agree, that things are going to be seen as more politicized. And there was a new study that said that the Supreme Court justices are influenced by kind of the media that they consume like the rest of us. So they're on Twitter too. I was at a talk that Justice Kagan gave, and I was tweeting about what she said. And then I met her at the dinner, and I went up to her and introduced myself. And she said, "Oh, you're the one that's been tweeting about me." So she's on Twitter. They're getting messages too. They come from Justice Scalia used to listen to talk radio, and so what he was hearing. And what his worldview was colored by the very things that political people do.
Let me move from the more general to specifics. If you were to pick one area of law, where do you think that Justice Scalia has had the greatest effect?
Well, he himself said that he had his greatest effect in areas where there was where he could write a majority opinion, which would mean something like the Heller case. The Heller case is the case that recognized that people have an individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. It's a very interesting decision because there's a line in there that says this doesn't mean that laws that bar felons or the mentally ill from getting guns can't get guns. And in fact, Justice Thomas recently complained that Heller didn't go far enough and that it actually the Second Amendment's become like an orphan at the Supreme Court. It's not hearing those cases. I wouldn't say that's where he had his greatest influence, although he might have said that. I would say he had his greatest influence in terms of, and this is somewhat technical, but how courts read statutes. And so Scalia had this view of textualism that you basically look at the words of the statute. If the words are unclear, you apply different rules of thumb, what he called canons of construction, rules of grammar. And so literally, you have Supreme Court cases now where, well, I looked at the third dictionary definition in this 1868 dictionary, and it says this. Well, I looked at this 1900 dictionary, which is a better dictionary. Here's why. And they're fighting about dictionaries. Justice Kagan, who's one of the court's more liberal members, said at a Scalia lecture in 2015 at Harvard Law School, where she used to be dean, she said, we are all textualists now. I don't really believe that in the hard cases. You look at the Obamacare case, where the question was whether the law is going to go down a death spiral because of four words in a 2,000-page law. But in the lower courts and in the less important Supreme Court cases, Scalia has changed the way we talk about how to read a statute. So there's a case involving a violation of the Sarbanes-Oxley financial law. And the question the Supreme Court had to address was, is a fish a tangible object? Which is kind of an odd question. Justice Kagan, in her dissent, cited to Dr. Seuss, one fish, two fish. But how did the court divide? They divided 5-4. Justice Ginsburg, the most liberal member of the court, wrote the majority. Justice Kagan, one of the more liberal members, wrote the dissent. And it was almost all about these tools of construction. So I think in the ordinary case, not the high political case, Scalia's way of starting with the statute and focusing on these rules of construction has profoundly changed the way judges decide cases and how lawyers write briefs.
My problem, though, with that is what you'll often find is there's words in a statute, and the court will say, we're focusing just on those terms, and the plain meaning is, and you read the words and you go, maybe? Maybe not. Depends on how you want to define the words, and it pretends you can find answers when it's not. There was a Supreme Court case last year dealing with an area of bankruptcy law, and it involved if some creditor buys a debt from another creditor, does the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act apply? And the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act is the law that says that creditors can't call you in the middle of the night, can't call your employer and the like. And the statute just uses the word debt collector. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Gorsuch, says, we focus on the plain words of the statute. Debt collector is the initial creditor, not somebody who buys the debt. And I go, but aren't they both debt collectors? How do you get that from the plain language? So is plain meaning other than they pretend that the words have clarity, even when they don't?
So I think that there's a law and linguistics professor named Lawrence Solon, who is at Brooklyn Law School, and he wrote a very nice piece where he basically said they're engaged in a parlor game where they're trying to come up with something that seems plausible but is not really the way English people, or Americans, speak English. So another example I give in the book, there's an opinion by Judge Frank Easterbrook, who was a former colleague of Scalia's at the University of Chicago, wrote an opinion about whether someone's going to get a 10-year enhancement of his sentence because he had... he was selling LSD, he was a drug dealer, and he had put it on paper because LSD is so light that you have to put it in orange juice or put it on paper to be able to sell it. And the question was, do you weigh the paper? And the law said you the sentencing enhancement of 10 years comes in based on the weight of the drug or a mixture of the drug. And Judge Easterbrook said, well, this is a mixture. Now, who would call a piece of paper infused with LSD a mixture? And this guy went to jail for 10 more years. So I'm very critical of this approach. I think this is a bad development in the law. But you asked me what I thought his greatest influence was. I think it's moved us in this direction. I much prefer, and if you're looking for a great book that responds to Scalia on this, Judge Bob Katzman, who's the chief judge of the Second Circuit of the United States Court of Appeals, wrote a book called Judging Statutes, where he says, why would we not look at what Congress might have intended and put into a committee report? Why wouldn't we look at all the surrounding circumstances? Why wouldn't we take context into account? Doing it Scalia's way is going to make it worse, and we're going to give judges more discretion. Scalia used to say that looking at legislative history like a committee report was like going to a party and looking over the heads of the people trying to find your friends. And what I say in the book is it's the same thing with what's going on with textualists, except they're fighting over dictionaries, which is even worse, because dictionary definitions are never the way people actually speak. You know, it's a moment in time captured by a single individual, and it doesn't give you the context at all.
You have a piece in Slate this morning that's very consistent with the thesis of the book, that Justice Scalia will have more influence now that he's no longer alive and into the future than he had while he was a justice on the court. Why do you say that?
So we talked about the Federalist Society and how they have all, or most of them, have agreed with Scalia. In fact, their biggest criticism of Scalia is that he wasn't Scalia enough. That, you know, there were some times when he wouldn't follow originalism, or he wouldn't follow textualism, or he wouldn't be conservative enough. President Trump has essentially outsourced the choosing of judges to the Federalist Society. And all of the judges on his list of possible Supreme Court justices, they're all Federalist Society members. Justice Neil Gorsuch, who's the newest member of the Supreme Court, is not only a Federalist Society member and a common speaker at the Federalist Society. He has said, we are all originalists, we're all textualists. He buys into this. And is deciding cases in this way. And in fact, he has been, he's like Scalia on the court, but without that charm and wit. So there was a moment at the oral argument in the partisan gerrymandering case heard a few months ago involving Wisconsin's partisan gerrymandering, where Gorsuch says, can we get back to this arcane matter, the Constitution? Or in another case around the time of the debt collector case, Gorsuch is complaining about how a statute is being read, and he says, if there's a problem with this, there's a way to deal with it. It's called legislation. And so the tone coming from Gorsuch is of impatience, that this is now the moment. And so what I think is going to happen is, even if Trump is not reelected, and even if there's not another vacancy on the Supreme Court, and we have no way of knowing how that's going to go, Trump recently said he wants to put 145 judges on the federal courts, I presume within the first 4 years. This is going to affect all of us for generations, because the judges who are following Scalia and following his methodology, which usually but not always leads to conservative results, are going to be the ones who are going to be deciding these cases. So bigger dead than alive was my headline today.
Is it also that Justice Scalia's death could have played a key role in Donald Trump being elected as president? That Antonin Scalia dies on February 13th, 2016. When you look at the exit polls from November 8th, 2016, self-identified Republicans overwhelmingly said the most important factor in why they voted for Donald Trump was the Supreme Court. The vacancy on the Supreme Court for Republicans made the election of Trump particularly salient. And that, I think, it may be why evangelicals were willing to stomach Donald Trump as president.
And maybe still willing to stomach him as they're basically begging Justice Kennedy to retire so that they can get another Supreme Court nominee through before the November elections, when it's possible that control shifts from the Republicans to the Democrats. It's hard to say whether or not Scalia's death was a motivator. One thing I say in the Slate piece today is that people always ask me why those on the left are not as excited about court issues as those on the right. And I think the answer is that the Supreme Court's been deciding cases, if you look at the high-profile cases, about 50-50 conservative-Republican, because there's been a swing justice. There's been the Justice Kennedy, the Justice O'Connor. Just wait, as I argued in the LA Times a few months ago, just wait until John Roberts is the swing justice. He's the next swing justice if Kennedy leaves and Trump gets another appointment. Then you'll see on the left what it's going to be like with a really conservative Supreme Court. We haven't seen a conservative Supreme Court yet. Yes, there have been many conservative decisions, but there have also been a fair number. We got same-sex marriage in the last few years. There's still protection of abortion rights, despite the fact that a lot of these justices are appointed in ways that we'd expect them not to. Things can get much, much worse.
On that optimistic note, let me ask you a different question. You mentioned in passing a moment ago gerrymandering in a case that was argued in October. Another gerrymandering case was argued this morning. What's interesting is the last really major Supreme Court decision about gerrymandering was in 2004, and it was a Justice Scalia opinion that said the challenges to partisan gerrymandering can't be adjudicated by the federal courts. Do you have a sense of what the Supreme Court might do in these two cases, one from Wisconsin, one from Maryland, one where it was Republicans, one where it was Democrats, and what that can mean for a political system?
So the court held argument this morning. I haven't seen the transcript yet because I was on my way here, but from the reports I've seen, the justices are struggling. Justice Kennedy is the swing justice here, as he is in many cases. And Justice Breyer, apparently, at the oral argument said, you know, we've got the Maryland case, we've got the Wisconsin case, there's also a North Carolina case coming up. Why don't we set another argument in the fall, which was kind of a nudge to Justice Kennedy, why don't you stick around, see how this works out. In the short term, it sounds like Justice Kennedy, at least in principle, wants to find a way to start policing these things. But I'm concerned, as I argued earlier this week in Politico, that even if the justices decide to rein this in, it only takes five justices to change things. And the 2020 census will come, and then there'll be a round of redistricting in 2021. And by then, there might be a solid five-justice conservative majority that will reverse things. So here, too, Scalia, who took the view that courts were powerless to do anything about partisan gerrymandering because there's no principled way to know when taking partisanship into account is too much, that his view will ultimately carry the day, even if that side loses come this June. In terms of what it would mean politically, I think we know that there's more Republican gerrymandering than Democratic gerrymandering for the simple reason that there are more states controlled by Republicans than by Democrats. Democrats also engage in gerrymandering, as the Maryland case shows. When they can, they're going to draw their district lines to help one party or the other. If, in fact, the court decides to rein it in, it could affect control of Congress in the next election. We already know in Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, using the state constitution, threw out the maps and required new maps. That alone may account for six seats that move from Republicans to Democrats. So it could have short-term and long-term political implications if it sticks.
Underlying the gerrymandering cases, do we want the courts to be involved or just leave it to the political process? And that's, in fact, a larger frame for talking about the Supreme Court, at least since Richard Nixon ran for president in 1968 and campaigned against the Warren Court and campaigned against judicial activism. And there is a tone through Justice Scalia's opinions of judicial restraint. Do you think he's consistent about that, or is that another contradiction?
So first, I should say, in the political process cases, which are the cases I know the best, he wasn't even consistent there, because in the campaign finance cases, he was in the majority in Citizens United. He wrote a very famous dissenting opinion in a case called Austin. He said, this is all about incumbency protection. We need to strike these laws down. But yet, in the gerrymandering case, he lets incumbents go wild. And in a political patronage case, he said it would be perfectly constitutional for the governor of Illinois to fire a janitor because he was a Democrat. So
that would never happen in Chicago.
Yes. Where you're from.
Exactly.
In terms of judicial restraint, it's very interesting because Scalia was more restrained than, say, Justice Thomas. Scalia was willing to follow some precedents while Thomas wanted to overrule more. Scalia famously said to Nina Totenberg of NPR in an interview in 2008, I'm an originalist, I'm a textualist, but I'm not a nut, with a reference to Clarence, his friend Justice Thomas. There were times, so just to take one example, after the Supreme Court decides in the Heller case that there's an individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment, the question then becomes whether or not this applies against the states as well, because the Bill of Rights were written to limit the federal government, not to limit the states. And the Supreme Court, through a doctrine that developed in the 1920s and beyond, something called substantive due process, starts saying that some of these rights that apply against the federal government also apply against the states. Substantive due process is anathema to Scalia. It's why he says that the abortion cases are wrong. There's this huge fight to try to get Scalia to reject his views there and to adopt a wholly new theory, which could have allowed for the creation of a bunch of new rights that nobody knows what they mean under part of the Constitution called the Privileges or Immunities Clause that the Supreme Court essentially shut down in 1873. Scalia is asked at the oral argument on this question, says to the lawyer, "Why do I need to go this route? Are you trying to be a law professor? Why, you're making this too hard." And in one sentence, he disposes, "I'm following precedent." And Thomas issues 53 pages of, "Here's why I'm adopting a brand new theory." And I think the people who are following Scalia are much more going to be in the Thomas mold, much more willing to, I don't like the term activism any more than you do. They're going to be what the new term on the right is, judicial engagement, to protect economic liberties. And so we may see a new wave of what the left will call judicial activism coming from the right.
And I've got to say, I didn't like when Justice Scalia was being disparaging towards being a law professor, but there's also a contradiction there, because before he became a judge, he was a law professor. Yeah. I want to shift to questions from the audience. Before I do, just as a end question from me, how do you think history is going to regard Justice Scalia? Is it going to always be, he'll be the hero as conservatives look at him, and he'll be the villain as liberals look at him? Or is it just too soon to know how history will regard him?
So this goes back to our conversation when I said I was going to write this book, and you said, I don't know that we can really evaluate a justice until 50 years after that justice is gone. And I think that's right. And so I'm taking my best guess at this point in time based on what we know. And I think my book, Fairly Read, is as much about where the Supreme Court is going as where Scalia came from. My view now is that he is going to be lionized by the right. But because we're such a polarized society, he's not, you know, you can say names of great justices. You know, you can say Justice Brandeis, Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, John Marshall. You can name these justices. People don't really have political opinions about them. There'll be some point where people say Scalia who? But at least as long as people are alive who are around during Bush versus Gore, there are going to be Democrats who are going to hate him, or Citizens United. And there are going to be people who love him for as long as he has memory. What's going to last, I think, besides his snarky opinions in case books, is going to be his methodology and his changing of the nature of how judges and lawyers talk to each other, which I think is a very mixed legacy at best.
Why don't we turn to your questions?
Would you comment on whether Scalia was consistent or contradictory when it came to respecting and following precedent?
So this, again, was an area where sometimes he followed precedent and sometimes he didn't. So you can think about the abortion cases where he never would follow precedent, the campaign finance cases where for 25 years he dissents, never agrees to follow precedent. But in other cases, I just mentioned the case involving the question of the Second Amendment and substantive process, where he says, "Oh, I've already addressed that. See my last opinion." And he cites it, and you go back there, and he says, "I'm not going to address this." Sometimes he followed precedent, sometimes he did not. Was he? The thing is, I don't know that Scalia was any less consistent than any other justice. I want to make this point because some people said you're calling Scalia a hypocrite. I'm not. What I'm saying is Scalia held himself to a higher standard than every other justice. He said he was better than every other justice, and he didn't live up to it. When you're on the court for almost 30 years, you're going to decide some inconsistent cases. Sometimes precedent's going to give way, sometimes it's not. But I don't think that you can hold yourself out as doing law, not politics, without showing more consistency than he showed. And Erwin, you were going to add something.
I agree with you what you're saying. I think what we could say about just Scalia and precedent, we probably could say about all justices. There are long law review articles, whole books written, but when should the court follow precedent and when not? And the conclusion always is, the court should follow precedent except when it should overrule it. Isn't that helpful? But I don't know what other answer there could be. There obviously are instances where precedent should be overruled. Brown versus Board of Education was absolutely right in overruling Plessy versus Ferguson. And yet precedent has to matter in order for there to be stability in the law. So I don't know that Justice Scalia was any more inconsistent with precedent than other justices. It just depends on the particular area. He was eager to overrule Roe versus Wade. He never got five votes. He was eager to overrule decisions that limited campaign finance. He got five votes. But it's all about the particular areas, probably for him and the other justices as well.
This has been fascinating. Can you comment on his participation in death penalty cases? He was very harsh, I thought.
He was. And in fact, in the last chapter of the book, I tell the story of the very last majority opinion that Justice Scalia wrote in a case called Kansas versus Carr. It's a case involving really horrific facts about these two brothers that go off on this killing spree and they commit all of these horrific crimes and leave this woman naked, think that she's dead. She has to crawl through the snow. It's just really, it's so horrific. The case was an 8-1 case because the legal arguments were so weak that were made by the defendants. Only Justice Sotomayor dissented, and she dissented not even saying that the lower court got it right, but that we should give more room for the lower courts to have some flexibility. But Scalia wrote this opinion. It has a longer facts section than a legal section, which is unusual. There are facts included in this horrific crime that are not in the appellate documents that were given to the Supreme Court. Someone had to go back to the trial court transcript, either Scalia or one of his clerks, to get these details. So what motivated him to tell the story? So one thing is he was a huge supporter of the death penalty. And in fact, he dissented in cases that said that it was unconstitutional to execute those with cognitive disabilities or to execute juveniles, people who committed crimes while juveniles. So one thing is he was a huge opponent, but the other thing is it turns out that the Carr brothers who committed this terrible crime, they were kind of, that crime was a huge issue on talk radio and on the right because the Carr brothers were African-American and all the victims were white. And Michelle Malkin and David Horowitz wrote columns and were on the radio saying things like, the New York Times is not covering this because these were white victims and African-American perpetrators, and they're afraid of this. And so it might be that Justice Scalia heard that and wanted to give voice to those people. But he always saw himself as giving voice to the victims and was a very strong believer in the death penalty. You go back and you read what he says about whether the cognitively disabled, who he calls the mentally retarded in his opinions, could be executed. He said, why should they get any slack? You know, it was really quite harsh. So he was quite consistent in the death penalty area. I don't see any contradictions there. I don't know if you think of anything else. Or...
Scalia was known for being an originalist, taking the word of how laws were written, or the Constitution, over 200 years ago. What did he think, or did he think the same way about other areas that have evolved since then, current things that are happening, and not taking the view of what they meant 100 years ago, 200 years ago, outside of the law? So like societal events or cultural happenings, did he look at them through the prism of what they were like 200 years ago, or was he able to see and acknowledge changes?
So I say he was an inconsistent originalist. This is another one of his contradictions. So sometimes he would stick to just the words of the statutes. I'll give an important example, the Equal Protection Clause. He said Equal Protection Clause didn't protect against sex discrimination because no one at the time in the 1860s when the 14th Amendment was ratified would think that women aren't entitled to equal rights. And yet, at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment, Congress passed laws that allowed for what we would today call affirmative action. They said former slaves should be allowed to get special government benefits. That was the context of the time. And Scalia would say, no, let's just look at the text of the statute. And in fact, Scalia had a clerk at the time. He would sometimes hire liberal clerks. He called them counter clerks to keep him honest, he said. I give him credit for it because a lot of justices just want to hear what hear themselves. This clerk wrote a memo and said, listen, there's this long historical literature showing that the original understanding of the 14th Amendment was that affirmative action was just fine. You may disagree, but you should at least address it. Scalia never addressed it. He was asked about it at a dinner party by Jeffrey Rosen, the legal commentator, and Scalia laughed and said, oh, well, no theory's perfect. Sometimes he would ignore an originalist argument altogether. Sometimes even when Thomas would raise one, sometimes he would focus on current issues. And even in the Heller case, which he called his originalist opinion, talks a lot about contemporary society. And so even when he said he was doing originalism, he called his most originalist opinion, it looked at post-ratification history, it looked at current issues, it looked at balancing interests. Nobody, I think, could live up to what Scalia said he was doing.
Is another example where I heard Justice Scalia speak. I was speaking in a law school, and a student stood up and said, you say you want to follow the original meaning of the Constitution. Well, the same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment also voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. Doesn't that then mean, from the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided? Justice Scalia's response was one sentence, and I quote it verbatim. He said, "A broken clock gets it right at least twice a day." Next question.
And I should say, this is how when he was confronted with these issues, this is how he responded, with humor or with deflection. So at one point he says, "As Sarah Palin said, let me get back to you." I found a letter that he was asked to review a book by a Yale professor named Jack Balkin, a book called Living Originalism, which makes kind of a liberal case for originalism. He was asked to review the book, and he wrote back, and he said, "Since I'm not going to read the book, I can't review it. I will follow Disraeli's maxim, never complain, never explain." And so he at least followed the second half. He never explained when he was inconsistent in these cases.
What would Justice Scalia think of the treatment of Merrick Garland's nomination?
Well, I don't know. He certainly lamented the lack of civility and the rise of politicization. He was confirmed to the Supreme Court by a vote of 98-0. In fact, we didn't get to talk about this, but there's a point where in an argument about the constitutionality of a part of the Voting Rights Act where he says 98-0, talking about the affirmation of the Voting Rights Act, you know, something's wrong when something is reaffirmed 98-0. And the New York Times pointed out the same vote for him. I think all the justices, so far as I can tell, are unhappy with the process. It's not clear what to do about that process. But he was also, Scalia was somewhat of a partisan. There's a new book out by one of Justice Scalia's writing partners, someone named Brian Garner, and he claims in that book that Scalia was intrigued by Trump and was, and we know that Justice Scalia's wife, Maureen, had Trump signs on their lawn. So he might have believed, like Mitch McConnell did, this is a time to play political hardball because the country is very polarized. I just don't know. I have no insight. I don't know if you have any insight.
People often remark, as Rick just did, about just Scalia being confirmed 98-0. It's not that it was a different time with regard to confirmations. Instead, it was Warren Burger resigned as Chief Justice, and William Rehnquist was being elevated from an Associate Justice to Chief Justice, and Antonin Scalia was appointed for the Rehnquist seat. Civil rights groups decided they could only attack one of Rehnquist and Scalia, and they thought they had a better chance of defeating Rehnquist. In fact, there were more votes against Rehnquist's confirmation of Chief Justice against anyone nominated for the Supreme Court until Clarence Thomas was nominated in 1991. But the choice to go after Rehnquist is why it was unanimous with regard to Scalia. Everyone knew he was going to be a very conservative justice. I don't think anyone knew how conservative he would be or the kind of justice he would be at that moment in time.
Although I should point out, if you look at counts of conservatism, he was not the most conservative justice when he was on the court. There was always someone to the right of him, Thomas, Alito, in some counts. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
My question is directed at both of you. Would you be in favor of term limits for Supreme Court justices?
Since you said both of us, I'll say I am strongly in favor of 18-year non-renewable terms. Neil Gorsuch was 49 years old when he was sworn in last April 6th. If he remains on the court until he's 90, the age of Justice John Paul Stevens retired, he'll be a justice for 41 years. Clarence Thomas was 43 when he was sworn in 1991. If he stays till he's 90, that's 47 years. John Roberts and Elena Kagan were each 50. Life expectancies are thankfully a lot longer now than they were in 1787, but being on the Supreme Court for 40 years is too much power in a single person for too long a period of time. Also, too much depends on the accident of history. Richard Nixon got 4 picks for the Supreme Court in his first 2 years as president. Jimmy Carter got no picks in his 4 years as president. So I favor 18-year non-renewable terms. I don't know if we agree.
I do agree, but I would also add that Stephen Calabresi, who's one of the founders of the Federalist Society, and I would say the polar opposite of Irwin on many issues, has come out in favor of 18-year term limits. I wish there was some way to get the political will to do it. But I think now this is seen as a zero-sum game, and neither side's going to want to give up their chance to get that next nominee on the Supreme Court, especially now where if it's Kennedy or Ginsburg who leaves, the Supreme Court lurches very far to the right or to the left. If Kennedy leaves, lurches very far to the left if there's a Democratic president that gets to a point. So the stakes are very high. If there's a long logjam where the president's of one party and the Senate's of another, and they can't nominate, and the Supreme Court goes down in terms of the number of justices, maybe there would be space for this. What I think is more likely is if Democrats come back to power in 2020, they think about packing the court. There's no reason we are stuck with nine justices. We might have a Supreme Court of 11 or 12. It would be a radical change, but there's been an escalation. And so that could come. I certainly would favor the 18-year term limits over that, but we don't know what the future is going to bring.
Rick has written a truly magnificent book. It's about one of the most important legal figures, at least of the last half century. And I think above all, as you read it, you get reminded that what the Supreme Court decides affects all of us, often the most intimate, the most important areas of our lives. So please join me in thanking Rick for the book and a wonderful presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.